Deadwood Soundlab.
To ruin. I'm Biggs.
I'm Alexa.
I'm Alex.
So today we're covering Ishtar from 1987. We're just going to leap into the synopsis of this movie here. Chuck and Lyle are awful songwriters who are convinced that the only reason they haven't broken out is because they don't have an agent. After a really bad performance at an open mic night, they are offered a gig in Marrakesh by an agent. They reluctantly agree to go. They fly to Ishtar, where Chuck gives his passport to a woman named Shira Essel, not realizing that it would take a while to get another. Lyle goes to Morocco to save their show while Chuck stays and meets a CIA agent played by Charles Grodin, who in return for being a mole will get him to Morocco by the next day. Shira tries to steal Chuck's luggage to swipe an ancient map that will bind all the rebels of the Ishtar government together, but takes Lyle's suitcase instead. This is like the MacGuffin of MacGuffins,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it truly does not matter.
Nope. It doesn't have anything to do with the plot, actually.
Lyle confronts her and is then persuaded to her side. Lyle tries to use a secret code about buying a blind camel, but somehow winds up with an actual blind camel. Chuck and Lyle are instructed to go deep into the desert, where both sides are counting on them dying. Chuck realizes that his map is sewn into the jacket. The CIA flies out helicopters to kill them, but Shira rescues them. They turn over the map to the new agent, who blackmails the CIA into producing an album and a tour. As they pluck a terrible tune at a club, a military man screams at the audience, "Applaud! Applaud!" I want to start out with the music. Because the music, to me, is the draw of this movie. I think it's so terrible. It feels like in a genuine way it's terrible.
Their music, you're saying.
Yes.
Because the music all around is just like a bad knockoff of Lawrence of Arabia, or maybe like even Dr. Zhivago. But their music itself, so clearly trying to be Simon and Garfunkel, is so bad. It's just so painful.
It was described as Rodgers and Hammerstein mixed with Simon and Garfunkel. You take those two and put them together as not an enjoyable listening experience.
And they show them working on this song called Telling the Truth Can Be Dangerous Business.
Yes. Is,
working on.
Yeah. That is so hilarious watching them. And the only thing I can compare it to is that Beatles documentary, Get Back, where you see the Beatles working on things, but it starts out as a good thing that becomes a great thing. It starts out with the piano and you're like, this is not a good song. But by the time they're playing it on stage with a guitar, it's a real bad song.
Oh, and they keep describing themselves as songwriters.
Yes.
They're not performers. They're songwriters.
As if something prolific was coming out of this, like, where they can barely make themselves write a verse. They're like painfully staking how to do the second verse. That's not a songwriter.
Yeah. They keep like trying to convince the agent by throwing up huge obstacles that an agent would hate. So like they get the agent there and they're like, oh, no. We just got this one thing. We're just songwriters. He tells them you have to have a shtick then. So then when they go on to the open mic, they start to like dance around and like buck and wing. It's so bad. And you could tell they took like two takes on it, maybe. They're like exhausted. Again, Warren Beatty's just phoning it in. The musical experience in this movie is cringy to the...
And they keep bringing it back again.
Yeah.
Even in every act of the movie, you have to watch them perform.
I'm going to bury the lead a little bit here on this. I think whenever they're playing music and it's music focused, I really like this movie, which is like 20% of the movie, and everything else I hate about this movie.
Oh, no, I get it. No, it's
because
like
their highlights. The cringe stuff is like perfect. I mean, there's a part where Hoffman's playing by himself before they team up. They're better on their own, sadly enough.
Oh, yeah.
And when Hoffman's playing, there's a part where somebody's walking by him and hits his microphone stand and it does this thud. I've been on the stage at our local bar. It used to be in a small space, and people would go to the bathroom and they'd bump your microphone stands and stuff like that all the time.
All the time.
And never apologize, never notice that they did it or anything. They would just keep walking, and then you'd have to adjust stuff while you're trying to play something. So it captures those little details. It goes a little over the top, but I kind of love the ways in which it does. Like when he's singing for an anniversary for a couple who showed back up a year later. What was it? I'm leaving you some love in my will. Like, it's a song about this guy who's like going to die soon. So he's trying to make sure to leave her something.
Will. That's what I say. So it's like, that Roger had never seen, like, this is nostalgia show tune nonsense. They really throw it on really thick with each one of the musical performances. It's like watching the Muppets.
But the Muppets are good. That's the thing.
No, that's you just are suddenly like just suspending disbelief, like, hey, we're watching this performance. There's an audience. That's what baffles me. Any one of these like open mics, there'd be like three people.
Yeah. Well, they do a good job of setting up the open mic in that they show quick hits of four performances before it. They're good. They're not great, but they're like good performances, right? And then the crowd is getting into it. So it's clearly because they're in New York, I think.
Okay.
It's
crowded.
You can draw a crowd, but you have like a couple of bands that have friends that showed up probably, but then they come on and it's just like, there is no love, dude. There's no forgiveness from the crowd, and there shouldn't be. They're really bad.
I think it said somewhere in the production notes that they brought random people in for the audience too as just extras. They wanted the raw, like,
poor reception.
Exactly, from these horrible performers.
I wonder how long they had to play before people got over the glow of this is two of the biggest movie stars in the world.
I think there's still some schmucks off the street that you could pull in. They'd be like, who's that guy? I don't know, but it's probably bad.
Yeah, especially during
in
that
New York,
day.
Yeah.
Beatty hadn't done a film in 7 years, too.
Yeah, but Warren Beatty was like one of the biggest stars of the 70s, and this is 87, so it's not like he's that far from it. And then Dustin Hoffman is like still huge. Tootsie, I think, had just won Best Picture.
Right.
That was like they would have been filming.
It was 82.
82, yeah. So they won.
Okay. But it wasn't that far removed. And it was a hit too. Like Tootsie was a loved movie at the time. So
it also
like,
took
Well, he wasn't
years.
In drag, so maybe they still didn't recognize him.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's been 2 years too that they were in production of this film.
That's true. And some of their musical performances feels like it takes 2 years.
I still just think you can still always pull someone off the street who has no idea who celebrity is. As much as you want them to recognize them, they'd still be like, I had no idea who that is.
They still profit off this, and there's so much information on celebrity and whatnot, and they're like, people are like, who's that? It's like Denzel. They're like, don't have a clue.
That's what you want, though, right?
Yeah,
like,
you
that's
do.
What you want. You want people who don't know or aren't impressed,
And they bomb for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. The first part of them being like okay as themselves and then a duo with momentum is totally unbelievable as far as the movie goes.
What do you mean by the momentum? I'm just
so like
about that.
They're both have somewhat of a feasible solo career. Like Alex is saying, I don't buy it. How are they even getting these open mic gigs? And then they together get this agent? Are you kidding me? It's so crazy that they have that much success. Maybe it's just me seeing it in that, like, nowadays it's less of a racket going around for open mics and having success through that. They're so bad.
I will say the open mic thing is realistic to me, just in that it is an open mic. It literally means anybody can go up on the stage and play.
But as far as
Hoffman having a gig,
that's what I'm saying.
No.
No way that they have steady gigs. Exactly. Yeah. That's the part I didn't believe even just going in. That's when I had to start suspending belief, is that they would even have reoccurring gigs and that either of them could get an agent together that would even entertain them, let alone send them to Marrakesh. Like,
they
bullshit.
Do a smart thing with the agent, which is when he calls up the agent, he's got this messed up desk and he's drinking whiskey straight out of the bottle. And it's like very clear he's not an industry guy. Like he's another schlub. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, I can buy that he would be like, I'll take your money and I can find these little places that are just desperate for talent. But I think the idea of them going out of the States is unrealistic, but also he's clearly dropping them into war zones to play.
I tell you what, I got you a gig. big. It's in Marrakesh. And he's like sweaty and like that.
And the first gig is like, it's literally something about like, you'll have to watch out for landmines or something like that.
And they actually did.
Yes, they did.
Like, that's production though.
Yeah, that's production. And
they would have recorded that part after the desert part. Yes. So it's very possible they just added that in because they went through that.
Yeah, it was part of their production. Yeah. They went to New York twice. So they filmed in New York for the Palim, and then they went to Morocco for the big chunk of it, and then they went back to New York.
Yes.
There's a big debate whether they had to go to Morocco at all.
Do we have to? Yes.
Yes. They insisted because they thought that Hoffman and Beatty's fame was too big in New York and that they would have a hard time shooting these scenes without having a big draw from the peanut gallery that would be in New York.
They still did the New York scenes in New York.
They had.
They can't stage Morocco unless they're in a studio. So
they were. They had studio access in New York. They could have done it. They could have faked all the desert scenes and did all of it.
But you fake a blind cam.
So this is part of how this movie falls apart. They were going to film in the Southwest to save money. And then it turned out that Coca-Cola, who owned Columbia at the time, they were like, we have all of this money. For some reason, they could not transfer it back into America. So they had to literally bring the cash back.
Yeah.
So they were like, film in Morocco. We'll bring back all these mountains of cash with you from the production.
Launder money through Ishtar, which is...
Yeah, it kind of seems that way, right?
Yeah.
No, it's more like smuggle money.
Yes.
Through Ishtar. Yeah. Because they're not laundering, they're not telling anybody about it. They're bringing it. They're physically transporting money. So that's
and there is several stories of them transporting production supplies, film reels on production assistants on plane seats instead of shipping it because they were afraid it was going to get caught up in customs. And there's one in particular.
There was a to like stay in a hotel for a week.
Yeah. Beyond that, there was like a particular like very expensive camera part. I think it was like a couple. It was like a lens and some other prism that broke on the main production camera. And they sent this kid back and forth from New York to Marrakesh for a crazy amount of money. It would seem like for the production at the time, but it was cheaper than to have it caught up in customs.
That's how it always goes. I've done that's to this day. You send a person to physically bring it with them on their person. It does not get checked and you bring that equipment with you.
Yeah. At the time, this was kind of like a bit, this might have set some precedents because it was definitely not the normal procedure for productions of the day.
It's crazy if they looked at anything from this production and they're like, that's the way we should do it. Nichols and May back in the, I believe it was in the late 50s, early 60s, had a comedy team. They were all over TV, had a bunch of albums. Like they were huge. They were like the biggest comedy team around. When they split, Elaine May wanted to go direct movies. And I think her first three movies were like huge hits. She got a reputation for being difficult. Yeah. It's hard to put your finger on, like, was it because she's a woman or was it because she was difficult or was it a combination between the two?
Right.
She delivered hits and The Heartbreak Kid. Like, I love that movie.
Right. Rachel Gordon's great.
It's just fantastic. It's so funny.
Great screenwriters. You can take shit and then just transfer it into something else. And she understands how to make it into a movie. Take something of a totally different medium and put it into a movie's length. Yeah,
exactly. And she worked with Walter Matthau on the... for years before that, and then they did that weird, very sexist.
When her and Nichols come together again and make The Birdcage, it's the best.
That's so good.
It's so good with this. So, she's directing it and writing it. And then to have the producer acting in it. Oh, that's not
then
good.
The producer.
We have to have a discussion about him really quick. So Warren Beatty at this point had four movies that he produced and starred in, and they were all giant hits. And I think the most recent one before Ishtar was Heaven Can Wait. And she had written Heaven Can Wait, and then she wrote Reds for him.
And Reds.
And Reds went up for an Academy Award and was a hit. He was friends with her and was saying over and over again, I want to be the first producer she's ever had who actually gives her what she wants. And like, man, does that not turn out to be true? Like, that is, as soon as she said that, some old guy, like a wizened beard, yeah, like a harbinger of doom should have appeared. Like a thunderclap in the sky. And
so that's what we'll go off on that too, is that just on my judge, like, of acting, I do not like Warren Beatty. I really think that he has a bad pretty boy grin to everything. He doesn't really have a depth of emotion. He reminds me of a little based like Reynolds, kind of a boy model that ended up an actor, doesn't have chops. I just never see Beatty's chops.
Every time you're producing and you get to be the actor, that's the same thing, I think, too, is that you've got the money and the looks, and so you just plopped yourself in there because you were able to.
And he's making decisions like putting his girlfriend into the
third role.
Whom everyone hated.
Yeah.
I mean, to work with him, you can tell.
She knew she had a job.
She did have confidence for that. Yeah.
The deliverance of the lines is, the accent went everywhere.
Even if it's just the director and the main star goes out to that actor because they cannot get enough feedback, you need the director talking to your star and having that be two separate people, in my opinion, because at no point can you be a good enough mirror to yourself in the most tough scenes to give yourself the feedback that you need, let alone if you're the producer and the director in this. It showed me that it's the same thing. He has no respect for May, just phoning it in most cases. And it seems untouchable as an actor. In every scene, he's the same. Like you said, he's kind of burnt Reynolds and his way through the whole thing, just chewing gum the whole time.
Yeah, this is where the rub comes in on top of that. So him and Dusty had a big...
Dusty? Do you know Dusty?
He prefers Alex to call him Dusty.
Okay.
But the audience Mr. Hoffman...
And
go with Dusty. I like that. I like the familial sound of it.
Had a huge fight right from the get go. Watching dailies, I guess.
It's like two beta fish.
He was forcing him.
Who was forcing whom to watch?
Beatty was forcing Hoffman to watch the dailies on all of these, and they shot so much footage. Hoffman was not impressed with a lot of it and was just like, immediately, we got to reshoot this. We got to reshoot that. This is not going to work with that. And trying to influence the director on most of this, it was intense from day one.
That's the other thing too. So Dusty at this point is super known for screwing up productions all the time because he lets his ego get in the way a lot. He's always looking out for his character, and that's always first and foremost. He got nailed in the public from the head of Columbia a little bit later in the run of this movie. And he had gotten nailed for it because he had worked on a production with this guy, and Dustin Hoffman was supposed to be the supporting character and had manipulated and manipulated until he became the lead character. And then the producer walked off the film and somebody else had to come in and take over. And so that's who winds up being his boss while Ishtar is like in post-production.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's more information than I knew. That is exactly. Like, I was like, went kind of down this rabbit hole.
This went from so kind to so cruel. The head of Columbia was Guy McElwain. And so this was a friend of Warren Beatty's. And Warren Beatty came up to him, told him he wanted to make the next Elaine May movie. And he said, anything she wants, period. That's my negotiating position. And McElwain looked at it and he was like, Hoffman's difficult. Beatty's difficult. May's difficult. Putting the three of them together, this is going to be a bad idea. But it was also that whole thing of like running in fear, because you're like, if this winds up being a hit, I'll be fired. So he took it on. He winds up losing his job because of this movie.
Damn. No, he has to. He's the one. The pre-production of this movie was so nonchalant, too. It sounds like that they were just like, green light! Just go for it.
The same people who could have then seen the three-headed Hydra of May, Dustin, and Beatty and been like, oh, no. We're like, oh, yeah, great. Oh, yeah. These guys are all hit makers. Yeah. What could go wrong?
And May finishes the script, does a table reading with Beatty and Hoffman. she's done as far as she's concerned. And Beatty and Hoffman are looking at it and they're like, this needs a lot of work. Hoffman thought it should completely be centered in New York and never leave New York.
And still be called Ishtar.
And then Beatty's compromise with her was like, we'll keep working on this and get something that we want. But that meant that they were working on it all the time and arguing about it all the time.
All the time.
They did not have a locked script when they started.
Kind of justifies Dusty's pushing too, is because no one ever actually gave Dusty a solid boundary. You know, with people like Dusty, you got to be solid.
And he was allegedly friends with May as well, because she had written Tootsie. And like, they had a really good experience
from
together. Because Hoffman was pushy on it.
Yeah.
But like, May was changing it to make him happy too.
Which then led to good things. I can see her getting it from both of the boys in this. It's like a play where they bring in people that are really good and they want you to just improvise the whole thing. And it falls under the egos of the two people. Like you said, you like the music parts, but that's what I get every time I see the musical. When they're singing and dancing, I just feel their egos crushing the movie.
To me, it feels like that's when May really, really has something to say in the movie, which is like, honestly, how egos will just like lead you to do these like terrible things and embarrass yourself and nobody will tell you the truth. Like not a single person tells either of them how horrible they are in that movie.
That's a great distillation. The fool feeding the fool.
They realize they're not good until they're together and then they feed each other's ego.
Except for their audiences. Which they do not listen to.
That's the thing, though, is they're not listening to the audience. Their audience is each other. As soon as they find each other, it's totally believable. Like I said, it's highly unbelievable that either of them would be successful enough to find each other and form a gig together. But once they find each other, it does make sense. And there are these musical acts that encourage each other just like that. And so that part of the movie, I 100% believed. Where they both think they're dating the same woman who has no interest in either of them.
Yes.
100% believe that.
Yeah. When they're in front of the Sam Goody. And they're looking at the albums. I think it's like Simon and Garfunkel's Greatest Hits.
Yes.
I think it's Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA. It's the Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense. All of these records are like available and they're talking about, what do those guys have that we don't? And he's like an agent. As far as he's concerned, it's just, we don't have the in into the industry.
Yeah. Doesn't have anything to do with our talent.
The way that they form the music together and have their little masturbatory session of creation, as they would call it, is so great. I have witnessed that a lot when I was in
I've been a part of that
art college. Yeah, I saw it. Yeah, me too. I was
we've all been there.
There's drugs involved. Yep. Or maybe just late night and you're like so needing to make something creative by the next day for your professor to have, and you just drunk on unnecessary deadline.
Yeah.
And then you just make this garbage float, and then heaven forbid the professor like it.
Oh
yeah. And then the two of you are like, I told you we had something together.
You do. You
and then Professor So-and-so really liked us, and now the egos are never going to be calmed by anybody else again.
That piece of garbage was floating down the river. You just threw a match on it, and you're like, see, it's pretty.
And that's why I like the ending of it, at least, of everybody being whipped to applaud these two buffoons.
It's
so perfect, because they, just like the movie, bullheadedly force their way through this entire production, and then in the end, kind of just get a pat on the back, just like the actors did. Oh,
and the whole like middle section, you can just skip.
It's I fell asleep the first time.
Everything in the desert is garbage. Everything.
Oh my God. And the lines that they give to each other, it's just like line, 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 line. It's like an A and B, but none of them, again, are listening to each other. So the joke is just like them.
They're clearly like, mad at each other and they're clearly out in the elements. They
shot
as actors look really tired and strung out and dehydrated.
When Dustin Hoffman is doing his la 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 thing to try and like pretend like he's speaking Arabic, it's like next level bad.
I blocked that out of my memory.
It seems like that he's more doing an embarrassing form of Yiddish, which is also really cringy.
Everybody's very offended.
They put it in the trailer too. They put they put it in the trailer
with
him just doing that whole thing. Like, it's hilarious.
So getting back to some of the difficulties on the shoot, they initially hired Giuseppe Rotano as their cinematographer, and this was Federico Fellini's guy.
Yep.
So he did Flash Gordon, which we talked about at one point.
Yeah. Same cinematographer. Yeah.
Because the pre-production gets delayed so much, he can't do it because he's already locked into Hotel Colonial. So then they go and hire Vittorio Storaro, who had worked on Reds with Beatty.
Mm.
And they think he's he's going to work really well because he's won a couple Academy Awards at this point for Reds and Apocalypse Now.
Oh, he shot Apocalypse Now? Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
so
a lot.
He's been on some shit shows, yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Yeah, that's so he knows how to navigate.
Dude is actually what went through my head. So he's been through hell and back.
So I just want to say this one thing just so we can understand the shit show we're in for. So in 1998, this guy, Storaro, he invents the Univision format.
Yep.
And so the idea is we're going to come up with this format that will work for video. It'll work for film. So basically, like, it's the same aspect ratio that's on the screen is in the VCR. And then he goes back and takes all his old movies and he puts them into Univision, which, like, pisses off a bunch of movie purists because, like, you're cutting off part of the frame. He's very much also a perfectionist and wants things done a particular way, and in his own mind is kind of like one of these guys who innovates. And so he shows up, and every single shot he's doing, he's trying to get something that looks the best cinematically.
Yeah.
But Elaine May is like, no, we have to work on this blocking and things like this because we need to make sure we sell the joke. And he straight up refused and would get in screaming matches with her constantly because he's like, no, we need the shadow or something like that to make it look beautiful. But she's like, we need to sell the joke. We're making a comedy. And he just did not understand how to shoot for comedy.
Yeah. And that's what she does so well. Back to the theater part of it. She knows how to set up the physicality of comedy.
Yeah. There's a distinct lack of close-ups too.
Most of those battles were lost by Elaine May because Warren Beatty would swoop in on his side. And so in addition to trying to get bigger parts because the script isn't locked, he's also like trying to be like, just listen to the guy. He knows how to make it good. He's got Academy Awards.
Yeah.
So you can tell when you watch the movie, like, yeah, there's some dunes that look amazing in it, but also it's not very funny in the middle.
Nope.
And I got to think that probably contributes to it a little bit.
Yeah. The big deal with this film was like 60-something 1 minutes to 1 minute of used footage, cuttable footage. So they like wasted more film on this whole production than probably 10 other films combined.
I wasn't able to find it again for this to get the raw numbers of it, but I have heard before they shot more miles of film than any movie in history.
Yeah.
Like, and that's locked now with digital. Yeah. Like, that's just a record that's there and you can look at it. It's not going anywhere. You
know? I love that.
Well, someone's really swinging for failure.
Yeah.
And part of that, too, is Beatty completely loses confidence in her ability to direct when they're doing all this stuff in the Sahara. So when they come back to New York, he goes and tells the head of Columbia, I don't trust her. We're going to shoot double everything. We're going to do it her way and we're going to do it my way with literally every single scene.
Yeah.
You get to like the last third of filming and you're just like doubling up on all your film now.
Oh, that nuts. Poor editor. Jeez.
Well, the editor was Elaine May.
Elaine May.
What? She's seeing both of these
I wonder which one she's going to go with.
Here's the end of it, too. That Dustin Hoffman started demanding being on the cutting room floor.
Yep.
And then shortly followed, Beatty finds out that Dusty's over here fucking sitting in the cutting room floor. The Hydra is in the editing room, too.
Of course they are, though. Look at that.
With fucking everything. They're monsters.
Because Elaine May has had so many fights with that actress, she winds up refusing to record her ADR, so she'll just have like a production assistant or something come in, so that pisses off Warren Beatty even more.
Well, let's not even say that they have an explosive breakup on the set. Warren Beatty and the other actress.
Isabel Adjani.
Yeah.
They have some explosive breakup in the middle of the set. And then she's booked for the rest of the gig. So they're trying to get rid of her as soon as they can. So they're like abridging scenes and like forcing production in the middle of it.
And then there's all these crazy costs that don't need to happen. For example, they're scouting out sand dunes. And Elaine May doesn't like the look of a lot of sand dunes. And so she finally settles for this one. They film a whole day and she's like, no, this doesn't work. I want it leveled. So instead of going to another location, they literally spend 5 days leveling a sand dune so that they can film there.
spot.
Like, whoa, that's 5 days of just one. Like you could halting spend, production.
You could spend 5 days just to find a flat spot of Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy. There's just so many things like that. Or when they go to New York, there's union rules. They have to like have a New York crew.
Oh, yeah.
They're paying a New York crew to show up and literally not do anything. And they have to pay them the full amount. So it's like they're paying two different crews. Even though she's fighting with the cinematographer, Beatty doesn't even say, let's just let him go for this part. No, let's pay for two crews, one of which we're not going to use.
$5 million budget. That's nuts.
That's so crazy that the movie starts to disintegrate towards the end so much in production and in everything else that it's like fission. It's just dividing itself into two and there's double of everything.
It's nuts. You can tell now, kind of like look, discussing the bits of it. It makes more sense as it pieces together as a jalopy of a film.
So they hire Paul Williams to come on, who's a really good composer, right? Yeah. Like he did the Rainbow Connection for the Muppets. You were talking about the Muppets earlier. Feels a little bit like the Muppets. Guy wrote the most famous Muppet song, right? Yeah. He also did like We've Only Just Begun for the Carpenters. He also did the voice of the Penguin in Batman the Animated Series. Just a weird little factoid.
It's a nice one.
She brings him on. They write all these complete songs. They know they're only going to use 30-second clips for some of these songs, but Elaine May insists we need to write an entire song, and everything had to be written badly, which to me is like, why did you hire a good musician in the first place who like has a giant quote if you need to write badly? Like, I know people say that making something bad for comedy is hard. I don't think it is, dude. You just have to find somebody who's bad.
You gotta find like the local like jangle writer and you give them a find the check.
Real life version of those guys and have them do songwriting.
Wow. Because there's a certain amount of bad good cringe that you can't duplicate, especially as someone who's proficient as a musician. You can't spoof bad. You can only just have an off day and have that be funny. When she does the Birdcage and they have those songs, you can tell because there's a couple of deleted scenes in it that show the rest of the song and how it's this entire, just the same scenario. She's written this entire full length song for what, 15 seconds of a scene, and it's perfect because it's good. But when she insists that it be bad, she's pushing it too far. She can't direct the bad. She's good at directing good, but when she should have just had him do it good, done it well, written, had the man compose a good song, and then just had those two ass clowns do it anyway. And it would have been so bad. Even if they did a good song, those two with given the prompt, do it like you think you're Simon and Garfunkel, would have been so bad.
Those lyrics are kind of perfect for this. I will say that. And I know Elaine May helped write the lyrics, but it's because you can tell these are musicians that are trying to be very deep.
Right.
But it's shallow because that's what I'm saying. You're they grabbing get in their a own metaphor way. That doesn't work.
And they get in their own way. They're obviously not, even as much as they're accidentally writing poetry, they're not anywhere near inhabiting a space that actually gives their words any kind of justice. Because they're neither of them are singers. Like, performers.
No.
Yeah, they were reaching out in different places. It was just like, okay, these guys will do. They're not musicians, but we're going to write a script about musicians.
About them like, being songwriters when they're not.
I just don't think you have to pay Paul Williams for that. I think you can pay the minimum amount for some schlub at an open mic night to
Speaking of, that's where you surf the open mic night. Pick two turds up there and you're like, hey guys.
Who show up regularly and are super enthusiastic. Yep.
And you're like, you guys want to write some tunes
and you
for
don't
this
let
movie?
Them in on the joke of nope. what you're doing.
Exactly.
Get him to sign better. The paperwork. Yeah,
save a lot of money in production.
And then you could have blamed them for the whole debacle later.
Yeah. Exactly. You got two scapegoats.
So when McElwain gets fired from the head of Columbia, it's David Putnam that comes in. Mm. And so he's the one that puts Hoffman on blast. He also put Beatty on blast because he had spent so much money on Reds.
Blast away. That's what I say to anything with Beatty.
So Putnam goes out in the public and he basically says, I'm staying away from this production. And part of it is because it was greenlit before him. So he's trying to distance himself from it. But he's also saying like, I've already said these things about Hoffman and Beatty, so I'm going to pull myself from any involvement in the film so that they can get it finished. But then he's most likely leaking all sorts of stuff of the problems into the press. And so like this movie, a year before it comes out, is already getting the nickname just of our riddled. Show, The Road to Ruin.
Yeah, just riddled.
They're just coming up with all this awful stuff about it because Beatty is not liked by the press. And so they're eating up anything that they can hear about a troubled production with him. It finally comes out. So the budget was set for 27.5. It actually wound up going for 51 million. It made 14 million. Awful. So if you adjust that to 2000.
Global too. Like it made only like 4,300,000+.
And if you were adjust that to 2023 numbers, made 38 million off of a $136 million budget. So that's a big time bomb. Almost losing 100 million.
They also were number one the first week, and then they immediately got knocked out of the park by Beverly Hills Cop 2. Just trounced them. I think Eddie Murphy says that movie got shot so quick, I don't even remember it from the second or third one. Like, such easy money in stark contrast from Ishtar to Beverly Hills Cop 2. Guaranteed money in the bank. We're going to shoot this thing in a couple of weeks. And bing, they nailed it.
There's something to be said about momentum to films, though. And that's exactly, I mean, Beverly Hills Cop is no gem, but the momentum of filming 1, 2, 3 is good for this, as opposed to Ishtar, who could barely get off the States and then
shot
back again.
For 1, 2, 3, but only got 0.72 of one movie, and they made it into a movie.
So the fallout from this, Coca-Cola went out to try and sell Columbia Pictures immediately after this movie. They wound up selling it to Sony because they were just like, we've clearly made a giant mistake.
That's right. It bombed so bad it took the production company with it.
And Sony bought it for a song.
A song written by the same dude.
David Putnam was fired after 15 months in the position. So 3 months after Ishtar comes out, he gets shit canned. And part of that was because he was slashing all the big budget movies. He's like, nope, don't need it. Nope, don't need it. And getting low budget movies. He got Spike Lee a start, for example. He puts out School Days, but not a big hit.
No,
you know?
It's a good movie, though.
Puts out The Big Easy, but like puts out a lot of stuff nobody cared about. And Coca-Cola doesn't care. They want a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Like that's where we're at in the filmmaking business from the 80s forward is like, we want a boatload of cash.
That's
on
what I'm
every
saying.
Movie.
Beverly's Hope Cop too. Make it.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, they said it was the worst movie of 1987. I just put together a quick list here.
Yeah, come on.
These are movies, in my opinion, from 1987 that I've seen. I've seen all of these that I think are worse than Ishtar, okay? And this is not sticking up for Ishtar, but the first one is unimpeachable, I think. Leonard Part 6, the Bill Cosby joint.
Oh, God.
And I don't mean because he sucks and we know about it now. I just mean it was
87?
A terrible movie. Yeah. Meatballs Part 3.
Oh, come on. Oh, man. Look,
Hard Ticket to Hawaii.
Wait, you've seen Meatballs Part 3 all the way through?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
No one has.
No.
And live to tell the tale.
Yeah. My Demon Lover.
Oh.
Ernest Goes to Camp.
Oh, come now. You take that back.
I knew this,
I knew this would be controversial.
Oh, Ernest Goes to Camp is a classic of Ernest movies.
We had to go back through and watch Ernest movies for a podcast I was doing. Yeah. And I realized, wow, these are so much worse than I realized.
They are.
Oh, yeah. They're not for rewatching. But the nostalgia points alone, I will say it's better than Ishtar.
Right. If I hadn't gone back and seen them, I would agree with you because I loved Ernest Goes to Camp.
Yeah, but
man,
as a kid, you watched it all the way through. You make me as a little kid watch Ishtar. I would have been gone by the time they were singing. I was out.
Nailed it. Yeah.
The Chipmunk Adventure is like an animated, 2D animated thing.
Again, me and my childhood.
Jaws 4, The Revenge.
Oh, it's bad.
Jaws 4, The Revenge. I should have known it went to a fourth.
Yeah, well, this time it's personal, Alex, so you really got to see it.
I do have to dip my toe in that
You
one.
Blew up my mind.
Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. How is Superman 4, The Quest for Peace listed in 1987 movies and you don't immediately go to that movie?
That's the turd.
They still made more money than this turd.
I don't think they did.
They lost a lot of money.
Comparatively.
That one buried Canon Studios.
Yeah, that
was
another thing.
Yeah, but this one buried Columbia.
Yeah,
so just comparatively.
The Care Bears Adventure in Wonderland. Remember
that
one?
What's wrong with that?
You talking smack?
What's wrong with
that?
Put
that bet. They
Again,
care.
Made plenty of money. Comparatively.
Easy.
I'm just saying it's a worse movie.
You just but this had Dustin Hoffman and the other's an animated movie about bears with rainbows on their tummies.
Care.
Who's teaching right. better morality?
Masters of the Universe.
Oh.
The He-Man one.
Ooh. I don't love, take me out good. To a good time and a steak dinner. I'll watch that like a slut.
Oh, I'll watch it, but I recognize how terrible
it's
it is.
It's so
but
bad.
Franklin Jella is Skeletor.
Yeah. Oh, that's God. What I'm talking about.
That's bad good.
It's so bad good. It's just like makes me smile and want to eat ice cream. Okay, go ahead.
Disorderlies. You ever seen this movie? It's like the Fat Boys.
No.
Had a movie. Remember the Fat Sorry. Boys?
No.
Yeah.
They were these three really giant rappers.
I can yeah. assume.
Yeah. And they're disorderly orderlies.
Oh, man. Oh, I know.
The way
I've
you're
seen
losing
this.
Steam is your
I've seen this poster or something somewhere.
You guys are just slightly older than me. It's, I see where this is going.
Yeah, it's bad.
Like Father, Like Son, the Kurt Cameron joint.
Oh.
That's a movie? That,
yeah, with Dudley Moore. And yep. neither of them are trying at all to do impressions of the other one when they switch bodies.
Oh, man.
It's a body switching thing.
I need to see this because my face off list is just ever growing.
Well,
so.
When it was on, it was on like TV when we were a kid. It would be like just on like randomly, like, what is this movie? And then you would watch like two scenes of it and I'm like, nope. Like, change it.
And then the last one I want to put on here is Teen Wolf 2, T-O-O, the Jason Bateman Teen
yeah.
Wolf movie.
Yeah.
They literally just redo Teen Wolf, but it's like.
But they ain't got no
but
Marty
But they're like,
McFly.
It's college and it's boxing, so yeah. it's different.
God.
You know how so many basketball players become boxers.
I forgot.
When werewolf.
Bateman too.
Yeah.
That one's really crap.
He gets made fun of it somewhere in Arrested Development.
So I think all those movies are B level. So then Ishtar was supposed to compete on an A level. And so when they say it's the worst movie of 87, they're saying of the mainstream could have been a contender.
I would say that.
Stuff.
Yeah.
I would almost say that, but I would say Superman 4 was supposed to be a giant movie.
It was.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I would say that one is still worse than Ishtar.
All right. Yeah.
And also Barry the Studio once again. So,
good God. You know, these studio burying films in the 80s.
Widowmakers. So,
yeah. There's not like a ton of great films made in 87, though, either. It seemed like
maybe
that was
we
kind
should
of
start in that direction.
Well, like 87 and 88 seemed like there was a movements in like bigger production companies shifting. One way or another, Warner Brothers got bought out. There's a bunch of like just weird
money grabs.
Changing of that. Yeah, and changing of the guards, these old guys that were just retiring or giving up or dying.
And a lot of them were just straight up selling their companies to giant
exactly.
corporations.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, yeah. And then you have these
who, in turn, like you said, were saying, show me the money.
Yeah.
Or else.
Yeah, so, we don't care about art. We don't care if you got to slap a 2, 3, 4 on it. We just want lots of money.
Not knowing that franchises come from an inadvertent hit.
Doesn't really work that way anymore, though, does it?
No.
Like, it occasionally works that way, but they're
you
usually
better
like...
hit it on the nail on the first try.
Dude, we've got this comic book.
Yes.
2 million people that love this
comic book.
They it's will guarantee they will watch it in theaters.
Yep.
Just to hate on it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just to hate on it, they will watch it.
Exactly. There's a lot of that kind of crap.
Plus, Netflix will buy it after that, and then we just love it.
Yeah.
Going back to Ishtar, so the rest of the fallout, I feel like Warren Beatty doesn't really get hit too bad. I mean, he takes a black eye in the press, but whatever, it's fine. Like, he keeps doing what he's doing. He produces too.
If he was producing, like, 3 previous hits, he was made of money at this point, especially in that old Hollywood. If they were,
he had plenty of scapegoats also to blame for it going sour. So
exactly.
Like Elaine May.
Yeah, he did not take it on the chin. No. He's like, oh, that's their fault.
Yeah, Dustin Hoffman really didn't faze him at all.
What faces Dusty?
Nothing. It seems like even being toxic on multiple sets.
Yeah, he's
like,
not really stopping that either.
No.
It's called acting, dear man. You should try it
sometime. You should try it sometime.
That's right. By the way, I love that he was so despicable that like people forget other despicable stuff he did. Like he was, I believe, a producer on an HBO show that he was in that like wound up putting down horses because it was about like horse track racing.
Oh.
And they just kept having horses die because of their reckless handling of them. And we don't even talk about it because, like, there's other stuff with Dustin Hoffman to talk about.
Yes, there is.
In the 80s, he's clearly untouchable. He gets through unscathed. Now, Elaine May never directs a theatrical movie again. She does an episode of American Masters for PBS.
Yes.
And she does a documentary on
Mike
Nichols.
And she makes fun of it. And she makes fun of Ishtar on it 2 years later or something like that.
Yeah. She famously said, if all the people who hated Ishtar had paid for a ticket, I'd be a rich woman right now.
Yeah.
So I felt like she had a good attitude about it, but it did seem like it. She was definitely the punching bag for all of this.
And big time.
It took 9 years before she wrote another script.
Yeah.
Like, she was so disgusted with Hollywood. And like you said, I think it was The Birdcage she returned with. Yeah. Like, she did and Primary Colors, both for Mike Nichols.
Yes.
Yep, exactly.
I think, like, go in with somebody you implicitly trust, right?
Yeah, and had success with and knew that you could actually work with.
The film that makes me really despise Warren Beatty is Bulworth.
I hate that movie. That was also my introduction to Warren Beatty. When I actually knew who he was, I saw Dick Tracy when I was a kid.
It brings up my blood pressure.
Yeah, it's so awful, dude. I can't believe people. And I always hear, and it's boomers. Just to be clear, it's boomers. Mm-hmm. But I always hear boomers talk about Bulworth, and they're like, oh, it's so good, though. And I'm like,
no.
See, because clearly you've never listened to a rap song, so you think that, like, this is a good...
It's
so bad. It's
talk
hard
about
to, like...
cringe. Like, yeah. Oh, if you want to sit through...
Oh, people
that watch him put on that black inflection on his voice. God.
Make hand gestures.
Oh, God.
Through the whole thing. Oh, man. I'm so embarrassed for him. Like, immediately.
Good. Someone should be.
And he's like third level high on like edibles through the whole thing. So I bet he doesn't even remember what is what on it. He's just like, he's like, I'm going to get high and do a hip hop political movie.
He has a lot of excuses when stuff doesn't go right. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's Elaine May or it's edibles or it was his co-host in the Oscars, right? Like, he's always got somebody to throw under the bus.
Yep.
Like, like, you saw him when he opened that envelope, right? You've seen that clip where he like opens the envelope and he goes, ugh. And he like hands,
like, can't read.
He hands it over to her. And he's just like, you jump on this grenade. I don't want to deal with this.
Exactly. No, his looks, he's not an actor. It's just like, he's genuinely being himself all the time, just cameras rolling. You're like, thanks, Warren Beatty.
So apparently Elaine May is going to direct a movie called Crackpot, allegedly. It's got Dakota Johnson. She had put it out in the press 4 years ago. But I went looking up.
She's ancient.
There's nothing.
At this
there
point.
Is no news. There is she is. She's like 91.
Yeah.
What and is she there is doing? Nothing. There is no news. So I don't think this is actually gonna happen.
Four years ago is right before the world ended, right? Like COVID.
That's
so 2019-ish.
But people are still talking about it, weirdly enough. And I've seen no evidence that this movie exists yet.
We love you, May. And if you're out there, do some more shit for us, please.
Do some shit. If you got some juice left in them old
Don't
bones.
Let the haters keep you down.
Yeah. I would like to see her get a good final act.
Word. Retirement's for quitters, honey.
Hell yeah.
At least in the directing. Because, like, script writing, she's been gold.
Well, here's the deal. Like, any of the one egos, or maybe even two of them together were fine. But then when you put the trifecta together, it was just like a three-headed monster, like you say.
That's the...
Tootsie, fine, or just like Beatty on his own, terrible, but like...
Did you get the cinematographer, you get Putnam, like
this is too many.
Yeah, this is the road to ruin.
It's real. They paved it. They definitely wrote the book.
They were like, okay, how can we really make this a quagmire? And
on every aspect of production, on front of the camera, behind the camera, and in post. Thank you, yes.
Yeah. Whoa, quagmire. That's right.
So what's your final verdict on the movie? I'm not even sure how we're going to rate on this show. We haven't really talked about this yet.
Yeah, we should figure out a rating.
I think sometimes movies bomb and they're good. Sometimes movies bomb and they suck. Sometimes it surprises me. And on this aspect of it, I'm not surprised. And the movie sucks.
Somehow bad movies succeed at some level.
And sometimes they're bad just because monetarily they just got shot in the foot somehow.
They just have bad time. You know, they just don't work out. This one, I think it's just genuinely should have been buried.
I think there's 30 good minutes in it.
Ooh, like, I think, out of 148.
I'd say there's like a good 20 minutes at the beginning and there's a good 10 minutes at the end.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It's like, a good short.
Literally, as soon as they like get into that cab to go to the desert, like if I was to do a Biggs cut, it would be like none of that. Mm. And then like, and then like when they get back together to sing at the end. Yes. That's the 30 minutes that I like in this movie. Problem is it's like, what, 92 minutes?
Yep. So cut the girlfriend out completely. And the camel. Who's the other girlfriend?
She can have a reaction shot in the club. Sure.
Yeah, that's great. And just the camel, who's the other girlfriend? That's what I'm saying. So you got the
Oh my God. Okay, one more thing that I cut out, but has to be mentioned. Just the last disastrous thing. And I don't even know if it's funny or not. I don't know. I kind of find it funny, but a lot of people aren't going to. They want a blind camel. This animal scout is looking for a camel with blue eyes in the Sahara, and they find one right away. And then he starts to look for another one because he's like trying to figure out where he can get the cheapest camel, which kind of smart, right?
Yeah.
Like that makes sense. It's one of the few times you hear it and you're like, that makes sense. You're shopping around. Well, he didn't realize that blue camels are super rare.
Yeah, blue eye camels are like hyper rare, like finding a freaking sapphire in the river.
So he can't find another one. So he goes back to the original guy. Guy already ate the camel. He ate the camel.
Yeah.
Maybe put a retainer on that camel next time.
Dude. Yeah, no shit. Finds it right away. No, I
didn't even know he had a really rare camel because he just ate it.
Yeah.
I saved the ice for you.
Road to Ruin is created and hosted by Alexa Prince, Alex Wolf, and Alex Small, and produced by Aaron Donaldson and Alex Small. The theme song Duke of New York A Number One is written by Dub Campbell and Greg Vibrette. It is performed by Tonight We Write on the album Of the West and can be found on Spotify. Road to Ruin is a Redwood Sound Labs production.
Okay, kiddo, I lost my library of sound, so I need you to do some sound effects for me.
I don't want to do this, Dad.
Look, I'm just trying to put food on the table, but if you don't want to help...
All right.
Hear Biggs chronicle a galaxy of genre. Listen to the deconstruction of film on A Cosmic Void. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you have a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast, Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. You can find all of Redwood Sound Lab shows at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.